We are all the way up to Genesis 9. And I'm not going to do the recap like I do every week, all the way up of all the chapters going up, but just the two basics. Number one, what did we learn about the people in the Bible? They're screwed up. And God can still use them. And number two, what is the story that happens over and over and over again all throughout the Bible?
Listen and obey
him. But what is the story? What cycle do his people go through every time?
Fall away from God and then seek forgiveness and
God restores.
That's right. So we love him. We fall away from him out of disbelief or lack of trust. So we sin, we fall into some type of slavery, we sell ourselves into slavery every time. Then we call out to God in supplication or prayer. Then he gives us peace, he saves us, rescues us, and we have a time of peace with him until we fall off into lack of trust again and then go through the cycle. So we have gone through, we've just finished up the flood in chapter 6, 7, and 8. We learned a lot of interesting things. One of the biggest things is Noah was considered a man of faith because why? God told him to do something that no one would make any sense of. A, it's going to rain. What's rain? I want you to build an ark. What's an ark? Okay, we're talking brand new stuff that had never been seen or experienced. And this stuff started after he was 500 years old. And the rain didn't come till he was 600. So there's 100 years of obedience, acting completely on faith in the word of God that had to go on there. If 50 years through he'd said, you know what? I just don't see it happening. I've given up. Right? How many of us, God has spoken something to us and it's a long-term goal, a long-range goal, and we just go, I just don't see it happening. And we give up. But here is Noah, looking like a fool in front of the entire generations and populations around him, and having to invest his own money, training up his children to believe in what he believes, everyone coming together. This cost him everything, right? And then we also learned that when God gives us a vision, something for us to do, he will give us exact instructions if he needs us to have exact instructions. He will. He said exactly the cubits, exactly where the door should be, how many levels, exactly the length, what kind of wood, all of that. And remember, it's God who shut the door on him. We asked the question last week, if Noah had not obeyed God, would he still have been saved? The answer would be no. Because he was working out his faith, his salvation, on the outside. He had faith, and it was showing on the outside. Our faith without works is dead. And the ark is the external expression of Noah's faith in God. Down to the last detail. And if Noah had said, well, you know what? I think we should probably put a window over here. Noah's wife said, you know, I really don't like it like that. Can we not put on a fourth one, you know? But no, he had to do it exactly because imagine this. There had never been a flood before. There had not been these boats. There had not been rain. How could anyone on earth, literally, have come up with a vessel that would hold the exact amount of animals and that would withstand the storm from the springs coming up and the rain coming down? Only God knew the exact way that that ark had to be built. So if he had not listened to everything that God had said, he wouldn't have been saved, because either he wouldn't have believed, he would have stopped, or the boat would have sunk. So God, the good news is if he's telling you to do something, if he hasn't told you how, hold on. When you need to know, he'll tell you exactly. Like the Jesus text me that you got at 3 o'clock the other day that said, I will tell you what you need to say if you're called on to speak. It's a whole nother level of faith. But that's what Noah did. And so Noah came through. We also found out that it took some extra faith, because even after the 40 days and nights of being absolutely thrashed by a storm, anybody remember how many days it took for the waters to recede? 150. So sometimes after the storm is over, you still have the consequences after the storm. You still got to wait out a bunch of other stuff that happens. So now we come to 9. All right, they have disembarked from the ark. The birds didn't come back, and so they knew it was safe. God blessed Noah and his sons and told them to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. The fear and terror of you will be in every living creature on the earth. They are placed under your authority. And now, for the first time, every living creature will be food for you. Before, it was only green plants, but now you can eat animals. However, the lifeblood must not be in it. So they started out basically vegan. And now, there are several different things that are interesting here. The fear and terror of you will be in every living creature on the earth. There was not that type of relationship between man and animals before that. This is the first time. Now, there is no necessarily straight out answer, but I just want you to see how the difference between the garden and the relationship between man and creation, and now the relationship between man and creation, how sin enters in and corrupts everything. When there is sin in our life, it then has this domino effect, or like throwing a stone and it ripples and it affects everything else. Who would have expected that creation itself would end up being corrupted because of man's sin? That creation would be wiped out. The face of the earth was wiped out because of that, right? So we have to remember that our sin, no matter how small it is going to have that ripple effect in other areas of our lives. And even all of a sudden your job starts going weird, or things in your relationships with other people start going weird. Sin has a very far-reaching effect. It's insidious. It's like a slow poison. And it'll start killing off all the areas of your life. The next thing God does is to stipulate that all killing is not equal. Ronnie, okay. Now it says, all right, so you're going to be allowed to eat, and nobody should eat its lifeblood. Surely I will require your lifeblood from every beast. I will require it, and from every man, from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. As for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate and abundantly multiply in it. Now, at this point, it's very interesting. For the first time, he's allowing them to kill animals and to kill animals to eat them. At the same time, he says, no lifeblood. You can't eat it with the lifeblood in it because the life is in the blood. And second of all, then he says, immediately after that, no killing other people. No killing other people. Why would he say that now? You know, we were watching Criminal Minds. By the way, I deleted that from our Netflix thing. I just couldn't handle it anymore. You watch, and people get a taste of killing, and all of a sudden, it opens up the doorway for more killing or more things. There are certain sins in our life that are gateway sins. Okay? Which means you start off with a little sin, but it opens you up. And it deadens your conscience, and it cuts you off from the spirit. When you are in sin, in rebellion against God, when you're out of faith, okay, not acting out of faith. We talked sin is missing the mark. And what is the mark? Faith in God. As soon as we stop trusting God, a wall comes up between us and God. We can't hear him. Sin stops the communication between us. Okay? So at that point, if you can't hear from the Holy Spirit as well, with every little sin, it's like putting another, it's like having a tube of, a pipe of water, you know, like the sewer water or the regular water, and every sin is a stone that goes in there until finally the water is just blocked up. At first you can't hear God as well. Then you don't hear God as often. And finally you stop hearing God at all with your sin. So imagine you sin and then you become deadened to the sin. You have a seared conscience. It doesn't bother you anymore. God knew what was in man. He says, I'm going to let you kill the animals to eat them. But I know this is going to open up in you somehow a deadening of your spirit towards killing other beings. So at this point, he has to start making rules and regulations for them because they are governed by a fleshly self, right? And what does the flesh want? Whatever it wants. Now, is man going to really easily be able to not kill other people? Started with Cain. It's a real temptation. Once you have power to do something for the flesh, what does the flesh gain by killing another person? What?
It thinks it received Cain's power.
Power. Control. Right? Isn't that the ultimate act of control? Is taking someone else's life? And what is the basic sin? The basic sin is wanting to be God, to control everything. So killing an animal starts something in man, which A, then makes him not so sensitive to taking a life, right? And B, gives him a feeling of power. It doesn't take much for a person in power. They say that absolute power corrupts absolutely. This is where things started. God acknowledged the fact that man could really go way over the deep end at this point. All right, there must not have been wars up to this point. But now at this point, he said, you can do that. So I want to speak to your lives. Be very, very careful, A, about the little sins. Because each sin is going to block you that much more from being able to hear God. And the other thing is, whenever you get into a position of power or experiencing power over other people, that is a gateway sin. All right, that is something that can really take you down a very bad path because your flesh will enjoy it. You need to guard yourself, okay, that you will continually check in with the Holy Spirit, continually ask Him what you should do. Because otherwise your flesh will just run with it. And you will start thinking you are God and can do anything that you want. Okay? Now it says that the lifeblood, the word for lifeblood here is the same as life itself, wherever it is.
Almost there. It's in the middle.
Yeah, here it is. Life. Life and lifeblood is the same thing, same word. It's nephesh. Now, the word nephesh here, it's the Hebrew word. It means a breathing creature. That's what it means. It can be used in a bunch of different stuff. It might be soul. It might be life, whatever it is. But it's not biological life. I mean, meaning that it is the person. All right, the actual person who is breathing. A nephesh. A soul. Okay? And so anything that breathes has nephesh, and you are not to kill anything that has nephesh, that is breathing, except if you are to eat it. N-E-P-H-E-S-H. In the Hebrew, I think it's N-E-P-E-S. All right?
So is that saying that, like, game hunting is a sin?
Well, according to this, it says that he will require of an animal, even if an animal kills a human, he will require the life, the nephesh, that it be paid for by that creature. But it does say in here that you are not to kill animals except to eat them. All right? Just the delivery girl. Okay? But God is quick to follow up his warning about killing by changing the focus for man to be fruitful and multiply, spread out over the earth and multiply it. The focus for God has always been life and not death. Okay? So he has to come in here and he has to say, all right, now I'm going to give you the animals. And it just hit me. It's very possible. Why did he have to add the animals to the diet of man at this point? Remember we just talked about how creation has been corrupted? In the garden, everything that came up was good for man. He could eat of any plant in the garden, right? Except for the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. There was no such thing as poisonous food. Everything was fine. But by this point, the land is corrupted. There are poisonous things there. Crops won't always grow. Things go wrong in this world because this world is corrupted. Babies sometimes are born with birth defects or not born at all. This world is corrupted. So, I think that's just me. I just wonder if that's why he did not have to add the animals as well. Because there would not be, there wouldn't be enough necessarily always to provide. It's just a guess for me. All right? Not in there. So, all right, Ronnie, if you'll scroll down. Since man decided to make his decisions apart from God, which was sin, man brought death into the world. So God now must make rules and regulations to help contain the damage that sinful, selfish, self-centered people will eventually wreak. The next thing God does is makes the first official covenant with man that he will never again destroy the earth and its creatures by a flood. He does not say he will never destroy the earth. He says he will never destroy the earth by flood again. Because what does it say later on in Revelation? That this earth will be destroyed. There will be a new heaven and a new earth and a new Jerusalem. So understand the slight difference. And he did this in order to let us know. Imagine you have been in 40 days and 40 nights of rain. 150 days for the water to die down. And now you're living in a place and it starts to rain.
So I'm swimming.
Well, what is your first reaction?
Get in a boat.
You're like, who's not to say this rain is not going to stop? I mean, would you not kind of have a little PTSD about rain?
Live in fear.
Live in fear of rain. So God made a covenant at that point. He says, I will never again allow the rain to come nonstop and to flood the world.
He always wants us to look at every creation, even the rain, as something, a blessing.
Ooh, that's very good as well. Very good. So he makes his covenant. The rainbow in the sky after clouds appear is the physical symbol of his covenant. He had told Noah back in Genesis 6:18 that he would establish a covenant with Noah. Now, he said that before Noah built the ark. So if Noah had not obeyed him, God would not have entered into the covenant with him. So think about this. There are things that God wants to do in our lives. Covenants, is, and we'll talk about them in a second. He wants to yoke up with us. He wants to create something with us. He wants to accomplish something with us. But if we will not be obedient in the small things, he will not enter into covenant with us for the larger things. He who is faithful over few will be made ruler over much. We need to be good stewards over what he gives us at this time, no matter how small. Here is where the covenant actually happens. The word for covenant in the Hebrew means cutting. Ronnie mentioned this, but I want to explain to you why. It is cutting. The way that Hebrews and people in the ancient East would ratify an agreement between two parties is they would cut up and they would kill an animal, again, lifeblood. They would kill an animal, cut it up into pieces, make like a lane, okay, two lines of the meat of the killed animal, and walk in between it. And this is going to become very important later on in another covenant. It's going to be very, very important. So it's called cutting because you cut up the animal and walked between pieces with the lifeblood. And that's how you entered into an agreement with someone. Okay?
Like cutting hearts.
Ah, and that's another thing. Or cutting a deal. It's possible that that came from too. But the word for covenant means cutting. But that's where it came from. Let's see. Even in covenants, God uses the lifeblood of an animal to seal his promises. There's always, always comes back to blood. Blood is very important. Like he says, that's why he will not allow man or animal's blood to be shed just nilly-willy. Okay? The word is also sometimes translated as a league or an agreement. What's a league? What's a bowling league?
It's a group of people that share a common interest.
Okay. A common interest, a common goal, a common task. So another word, that word for covenant, cutting, also means league or an agreement, coming into an agreement, right? So this gives the impression of more than one person binding together to work together to accomplish a common goal. So this really encourages me because when God makes a covenant with me to accomplish something, When you've got a league, okay, the soccer league, okay, or one of the teams on the soccer league, they're all working together, correct, in order to win each game. So can just one person, and most teams, win by themselves? No, everyone has to put in their own power, their own skills, their own strength. They work together. So whenever God calls you to do something and enters into a covenant with you, you gain all of his what? All of his power? All of his characteristics? You gain his understanding? You gain his will? He is telling you, you are not in this alone. I will not ask you to do something or accomplish anything without me joining to you, yoking up with you, and helping you to accomplish it. Does that make sense? So that's why covenant with God is so important. It's just like a covenant in marriage, right? That covenant means where you go, I will go. What you do, I will do. I will help you in sickness and in health. You will help me in sickness and in health. It is an agreement to join together to accomplish whatever God's purpose is in our life, right? And a three-stranded cord means God is in there too. That's why when you take marriage vows, it's you and God. Because a marriage really, most of the time, cannot work without God. Because otherwise we will always be our own person, always want to do our own thing, always have our own flesh that we want to feed. And without God, without the Holy Spirit living through us, providing us with love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, meekness, and self-control, we would kill each other. Right? We would just annoy the crud out of each other all the time. So that three-stranded cord is where God enters into a covenant with the husband and wife. And that is the best opportunity, the best chance for a marriage to work. All right. Now, there are different types of covenants. Someone can make a one-sided covenant. Now, this is important because God has done this often. This one right here is a one-sided covenant with God. And that means he says, this is what I will do, and it doesn't matter what you do, I will still keep the promise. Okay? That is the covenant that God makes with us in salvation. But we're going to find out later on there are five different types of covenant. But this one is important because God made it alone to us. He said, I will never do this. He didn't say, if you obey me, I will never flood the world again. He said simply, I will never flood the world again. That is my promise to you. There's no portion of it. But other covenants throughout the Bible are not one-sided. The other ones would be, let's see, in the upcoming old books in the Old Testament, we will find conditional covenants where God says, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, then these good things will happen. If you don't obey me, then these bad things will happen. Now, starting in verse 19, Ronnie, if you'll pull that all the way down. Keep going. Uh-huh. There we go. Starting verse 19, this is where things go bad. Things go wrong. Noah planted a vineyard and proceeded to get drunk and get naked in his own tent. Interestingly enough, there is no mention that what Noah did upset the Lord. This is not used as an example anywhere else. Even in here, it doesn't say the Lord got angry with him or anything else. Because of this, commentators think that this was an accidental event. He wasn't a consistent drunk. He just, due to the festivities of whatever it was. Or some people wonder if this was the first time that there was fermented wine. I doubt that. Some commentators doubt it. But that it was an unexpected result. He didn't mean to get drunk. Or maybe it's because of his old age. Whatever it was, God did not condemn him for this. All right, so God does not hold us accountable for temporary lapses in judgment or unintentional sin in the same way that he holds us accountable for willing, deliberate sin. Okay? And this should both comfort us and make us very afraid. Okay? If we make a mistake, God is not waiting to punish us. But there will be the natural consequences of our actions. Getting drunk, simply put, makes it a lot easier to get naked unintentionally, to be found in compromising situations, and cause unnecessary shame to yourself and others. That's just the way it is. Now, we're using drinking as a, you know, it could be drugs, it could be whatever it is that makes you lose control of yourself. But the point is, even if God is not going to say, Noah, that was so bad, Noah has to deal with the consequences now. He left himself uncovered, and his son saw him, which then started something really ugly. On the other hand, God takes deliberate sin very seriously because it is rebellion and disobedience directed specifically against him and his commands. Think back onto his commands about taking another person's or an animal's life and the fatal punishment for that. So yes, if we mess up by accident, God's not going to necessarily whoop us or do whatever or take his blessing from us. But we will have to deal with the consequences of the sin, right? Like running a red light, and then the cop is there, and then you have to get points on your... whatever it is, okay? Those are the natural consequences. But the consequences of our deliberate sin, saying, I know this is wrong, but I'm going to do it anyways, that one God takes more seriously. That one, the consequences are not just in the natural. The consequences of deliberate sin also happen in the spiritual. What did we say happens when we do deliberate sin? Starts what? Separation from God. Separation from God. We can't hear him. We don't have access to his power. We don't know the right things to do. Okay? This also shows how God can use absolutely anything to reveal the hearts of ourselves and the people around us. In this case, how Noah's sons responded to the knowledge of their father's drunkenness and nakedness revealed the conditions of their heart. Anything that goes on, God, it says that God does not tempt us, okay? However, do you know what the word temptation means? Temptation in Greek is periazo, and this is what periazo means. It means to reveal to you what is already inside of you. God will allow you to be in situations where he will allow you to see what comes up out of you at your worst times. Okay? So in that way, God, you can't be tempted by God. He's not, how can I put it? If I am addicted to chocolate fudge frosting, and you come before me and lay a complete smorgasbord of coke, crack, marijuana, alcohol, I'm not going to be tempted. That's not what I'm addicted to. You can't tempt me with that because it's not inside of me. Death by chocolate, Chubba chocolate frosting, those butter cookies with the chocolate blobbies on the top. That we're going to have a problem with. Okay? That's when. So God will never make you sin. But he will allow you to be in situations that reveal to you your tendency to sin, or the sin that's in your heart that allows it to be manifested. One of the most interesting things I ever saw, and this was about 20 years ago, before I moved into the house in Canton that I raised my kids in after I was divorced, it had been used as a duplex. And there were people on each side, and the guy across the street was like a home health, not nurse, but, you know, he helped take care of people. And there was an older woman, and he would come over and bathe her and feed her and do whatever. And he would say, she was out of her mind. She was the most foul-mouthed, nasty person. The things she would say were just so gross and foul. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. If I should ever come to the point where I lose my mind, what will come out of me when I am not covering it up, reeling it in? What is really in me? Isn't that frightening? Oh, I got chills again. So that's why the situations you're in, God is continually allowing you to be in situations that challenge you because he wants you to continually come face to face with what is inside of you. Because if you will not acknowledge it, you remain in denial. And if you will not acknowledge it, you don't even have the option to deal with it. You still may say, no, don't want to deal with that one. But you need to realize that the situation you're currently in, the one that's challenging you, is there for a reason. He wants to show you what is inside of you. When they refine silver, okay, and it says in the Bible about as a refiner of silver that he will refine you. Do you know what the process is to refine silver? You have a vat of silver. You have fire underneath it. And you heat the silver liquid until all of the dross, all of the impurities, flow up to the top. And then what does the silver person do? It skims all of the impurities off. And do you know how he knows when the silver is completely pure? He can look over in the top of it and see his own image. Wow. God is removing the impurities from your life by turning the heat up in the situations in your life so that all of the impurities, all the nasty stuff in you comes to the top and you have to deal with it or make a conscious decision not to deal with it. And he will be done when he can look at you and see his own image in you. Isn't that cool? I love that about God. So anyway, so this is what's happening now. We're about to see what Noah and his sons are made of. So first of all, we know Noah, mistakenly or whatever, bad judgment, got drunk. So his son Ham comes into his tent and sees him drunk and naked. Now he had two choices. Actually, a couple of choices, but he could have just come out and left it alone. He could have covered his father up. He'd already seen him naked. Or he could go out and tell everybody what he saw. What did he choose? That situation revealed actually a sense of perversity in him. Somehow kind of did something for him. But even more so, it showed that somehow he had to go tell other people. He had to add more shame. He had to reveal the bad things about someone else to other people.
Yeah,
ruin the reputation. Now I want to talk to you about gossip and the different types of gossip. There are different personality profiles. There's the dominant, the D personality, there's the I, the influencer, the person who talks all the time, relationships are important. Then there's the slow and steady, the person who doesn't like any change. And then you have the perfectionist, all right, the conservative person, the person who likes rules and regulations. I's, the people who like to talk a lot, all right, who like to know information about other people, fall into two categories. The harmless and the power mongers. There are some people who, they're just interested. They just want to know. They just, they don't necessarily, and if they talk to somebody else about it, it's not because they're trying to hurt somebody else. They just can't shut up. You know, they just talk and talk and talk and talk. All right, but it's not malicious. But then you have what I call the power mongers. Power mongers are people who want to know because they want to be able to use it as leverage. Either leverage against that person, or it makes them feel more powerful when they can go around. I call them the information brokers because they know about other people. And so it makes them feel more important about themselves. Mm-hmm. So I want to have all of you guys really think about when you repeat something about someone else. Why are you doing it? Does it make you feel more important? Why are you even repeating it? Is it anyone else's business? Even so, really, even if it's good, I mean, unless it's a testimony of what God's done in somebody's life, what business is it of yours to share anyone else's business with anyone else? So what happens is, Ham is the one who found him. Instead of simply averting his eyes, he went out and told other people about the nakedness. What would cause him to repeat the bad things he had seen or heard? And this is a question we have to ask ourselves when we find ourselves talking about other people. Do you find yourself repeating to others the things you found out about other people? It's between you and God. However, his brothers responded to hearing about their father's indiscretion by still treating him with respect. They did not look on his nakedness or join with their younger brother in exposing what he had done, but instead tried to help their father retain his dignity and covered his nakedness. Backwards, exactly. So this makes me think of the New Testament where it says that love covers over a multitude of sins. If we find something negative about someone else and we handle it out of love, we should do our best to protect that person from ridicule and embarrassment, not be the one promoting it. Next come Noah's prophecies of what will happen to his sons because of how they treated him in this situation. Different commentators say different things about what this means or when the prophecies were made. Some people believe that Noah's parting comments were not made right then and there, like when he woke up, because the next thing it says is Noah died. So some people think that the prophecy we're about to read about what he said about his sons happened at the end of his life. And another reason why they think that is because he does not curse Ham. He curses Canaan, Ham's son. Now, his son would have been a small child, if even born at that time. So that's why I kind of believe that the prophecy, just like when Joseph's father, Jacob, was dying, he placed his hands on Manasseh, and I forgot the other one, anyways, and he blessed them. They blessed them, and Jacob blessed Esau and Isaac, okay, at the end of his life when he was going to die. So these blessings and curses were most likely not right at this moment. And the reason it says that he cursed Canaan is supposedly, Canaan had turned out to be a chip off the old block of Ham. Another reason why we watch what we do and what we say, because we model to our children. And they will become and pick up some of our worst habits. If you have ever been around a child and the first time you say a bad word, especially if you say it with emotion, like, they're like, rinse and repeat. They just say it over and over again. They're fascinated by this word. Right? So, here, the sin of Ham, against his father, it wasn't that one sin that was the problem. It revealed who he was. It revealed the darkness in him and his lack of control, his desire to have power over other people. All these negative things. And his son turned out to be just like him. So the curse is really not for Ham, because Ham by that time, for all we know, is, you know, about to be gone. But from there on out, Canaan would be the servant of everyone else, would become the slave. Now the Canaanites did become and lead and rule for a while, but then they were overtaken. They were overtaken by Japheth's, by his descendants. So the Canaanites were like the Middle Eastern people. The descendants of Shem were the Shemites, also known as the Semites. Anti-Semitic, anti-Semites, that comes from Shemites. So they are Semites. Those are the Jews that came, the Hebrews, came from Shem. And Japheth was basically, it said Japheth was going to have the most people. And he's basically all of the European, the Gentiles, and all the Europeans, everyone else, the mass of the peoples, came from Japheth. But Shem, small tribe as it was, this was the one out of which the Hebrews would come and Jesus, the Messiah, would come. All right, last thing here. Let me see. Now, it also says, very interestingly, may God enlarge Japheth and let him dwell in the tents of Shem. Now, they think two things of this. Number one, that Japheth, since they were the mass of the Gentiles and the mass of the population in the world, that eventually they would own the tents of the Hebrews. In other words, that they would become lords over them. All right? But some others see a spiritual side of this. If Japheth and his descendants are the Gentiles, and the Hebrews are God's people, the Israelites, then eventually Japheth, the Gentiles, could be grafted in with the Hebrews to become part of Shem's household, Semites, could become part of God's people. Because the Gentiles, it says that the Jews are the people of God, and Jesus came to save the Jews. But at that point, and it's really interesting, at the end of the Gospels, it says Jesus is, he said, I came for the Jewish people. I came for God's people to get them to repent, to get them to believe in me. But when they wouldn't, then it was time to allow the Gentiles and preach to the Gentiles so the Gentiles could come in and have a relationship with God. Mm-hmm. And just as a side note, I think this was so interesting. I don't remember the verse it is, but Jesus is teaching and someone tells him, right before he goes to be crucified, someone tells him that there is a Greek or there is someone from another city, two people from another city that are here to see you. And at that moment, he says, it's done. And this is when he's going to go off to get to Gethsemane. Because the time for him to preach to the Jews was over. God was now sending the Gentiles to come and learn and believe about him. That's just so interesting to me. So, that's the point here. And then it just says, after Noah lived 300 more years, and he was 950 years old, and he died. Now, the Other interesting thing about this, however, after Noah had his little problem, you never hear about Noah ever again. He was the only righteous man out of everybody on the face of the earth. He comes, he has his one little indiscrepancy, you know, his little indiscretion, but you never hear about him again. And you, maybe there was nothing more important, but it made me think of Peter. Peter, in the New Testament, he did something after he was right with God. He was an apostle. He was planting churches. But at one point, he and Paul showed up at the same place. And there were a group of Jews that were telling everyone else, all the Christians, that you have to be circumcised and follow Jewish law in order to be a Christian. Well, this goes against absolutely everything Peter had known, Peter had been taught, Peter had preached. That you don't need, that it's circumcision of the heart, not circumcision of the body. And the Gentiles didn't have to become Jews in order to become saved. And Paul talks about this in one of his letters, about how Peter wouldn't come sit with the Gentiles. He would only sit with the Jews. He got affected by those. He was afraid they were going to think evil of him, think badly of him. And that from that point on, that he did that publicly, sided with the Jews against what he knew was right, you never heard of Peter again. There is no mention of Peter ever again in the Gospels or in Acts. Never. So even though God does not disqualify us for the things we do wrong, our sin can render us useless to God at some point. It can disqualify us from His service. I don't know, none of us knows when or what that could possibly be, but if it could happen to Peter, what about Moses? Moses takes these grumbling, complaining 2 million-plus Jews through the desert, goes through all this stuff with him, and right as he's looking at Canaan, what does he do? Loses his temper, takes the rod and smacks it out of anger instead of doing what God said, which was to speak to the rock. And he was disqualified and could never go into the promised land. Now that's Old Testament and New Testament, God says. So we need to really watch ourselves. If we want to complete and accomplish what God does, we can't treat sin as, oh, well, it's okay, you know, if I just do that. No, you can be disqualifying yourself from the plan that God has for you in your life. And that's all that I have in this.